Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to turn today to NATO, which during the Trump years has been much more in the spotlight because of the president's critiques of it. And some members of the foreign policy establishment, I guess you can call them, have been aghast at the way that the president talks about it. But before we even get into the present controversies over it, let's start a little bit with the history. Map out for us what changes about NATO from its inception to today. Is the underlying value proposition different than when it was put together in the aftermath of World War II?
By 1945, in May, it was pretty clear that the Soviet Union didn't live up to its agreements to allow local and free elections in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states. Instead, the Soviet Union said they couldn't trust Germany again, so they wanted a buffer states of client states, the so-called Warsaw Pact. And then they saw that Germany had been divided. They did not want to unite it, as had been agreed on, so they took East Germany and put it in the Warsaw. And then the British and the Americans and the French collectively formed West Germany out of their occupational zones. And immediately you had a sort of weak Western Europe with this huge army of 500 divisions that had been so successful in World War II. So we decided that Canada, the United States, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, so the states that were across the Atlantic and to the north, and we kind of fudged pretty soon. We added Turkey and Greece, but largely that was the idea. And then in 89, the Berlin Wall fell. And the reason to be wasn't there anymore. There was no Soviet Empire and there was no Warsaw Pact. But then we came up with the idea that, well, the Soviet Union is dissolving. And even though we promised them we wouldn't expand, promised them, being now the Russians, we wouldn't expand, people in the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration said this is a chance of a lifetime to pick off these countries and move the borders of the West from, you know, the Elbe River in Germany, all the way over to Ukraine. So we began hand in glove with the European Union, westernizing Eastern Europe. And then we went, you know, from 8 to 12 to 15, and I think now we're up to 28 members, 29 members of NATO, or maybe that's the EU, and there's 23 members of NATO. And so it's not really the North Atlantic Treaty Organization anymore. It's all of Europe. And the problem with any alliance is that the more members that you put into the alliance, it's like a chain. That longer the chain becomes, it doesn't make it necessarily stronger because you don't know the value or the quality of each additional link. And so I don't know. In a recent poll of European countries, I think the Dutch, I don't want to pick on them, but I think that something like 15% of their population said they would defend their country. So I don't really think if Bulgaria is invaded by Turkey or Turkey gets in a war with Israel or Russia goes into Albania, that somebody in Amsterdam is going to say, you know what, they're a NATO member. They invoked Article 5. I'm there to help you. Put me on a plane and I'm going to fly over there. I just don't think that there's enough unity or cohesion that the alliance in its expanded and attenuated form without a common enemy is viable. So we have so many, we expanded it at the very time we lost our common cohesive enemy that lent unity to the alliance. And so there's some good that comes from it, but it's mostly political, cultural, economic. It's sort of a doppelganger to the EU. And Trump comes along and says, you know, a lot of these countries are running surpluses with us. Germany's got a $265 billion account surplus, largest in the world. And they're not even spending 2% of their budgets on defense. So we're not going to do this anymore. And, of course, NATO, and to most of the foreign policy establishment, is sacrosanct. You can't criticize it. And so there's where we are. And his art of the deal idea is that the more you bluster and threaten and cajole for 100%, they being the opponent or your opponent in the deal at least, will then negotiate down to a 55 or 60% deal. And so by saying he wants to get out of NATO or it's worthless or it doesn't do what it's supposed to, I think he's going to get these countries to eventually all devote 2% of their budget, of their GDP, to defense budgeting. And that's where we are.
How should we think about America's interests in staving off conflicts where we're not directly involved? If one pole is expanding these strategic alliances out to the point where they're not particularly coherent anymore, your example of moving NATO eastward, and the other pole is the kind of isolationist worldview of, you know, look, call us when the problem hits American shores, but until then we're not interested. Are there clear principles by which one can arrive at a position between those two?
There are principles if we can all agree on what NATO is. It used to be keep Germany down, United States in, and Russia out. Well, Germany's up, and I don't know where Russia is, but Germany, the successor to West Germany, has got a huge gas deal pending with Putin, and we're sort of skeptical of the whole thing now. But I guess what I'm saying is that I don't think somebody in Bakersfield, if we learn that tomorrow Mr. Erdogan in Turkey is going into Syria because he says there's Kurdish terrorist attacks and he evokes Article 5 and says, I was attacked and I want you NATO help. Or he says that he had some planes that were shot down in Syria by Israeli jets and the Zionists are attacking him. I just don't think that anybody has any commonality with this neo-Islamic Ottoman Empire that he's trying to create. And they're going to say, sorry, I don't think you're a NATO country at all. Just as I don't think that somebody in the Netherlands, if Putin goes into Estonia, which God forbid, I hope he doesn't do, I just don't think they're going to do anything. And so there's too many. I think an alliance can survive when there's one or two or three windows into it or vulnerabilities, but not when there's a lot of scenarios that we in the alliance can imagine, so we imagine that our enemies can imagine them too. So if Putin goes into the Baltic states, I just don't think those countries are going to get galvanized. It's going to fall to us alone. And I don't know why Turkey's still in NATO. It doesn't make any sense, other than they're a big country and they have some good real estate.
To the question about Putin, how much sympathy should we have for the Russian agita over the idea of NATO moving east? Because the most sympathetic interpretation is, look, you're taking this right to Moscow's doorstep, and any self-respecting nation is going to get a little squeamish about something that's that in your face. The counter that you'll hear to that is, look, this is by its nature a defensive alliance. So as long as the Russians aren't looking to make trouble outside of their borders, they don't have anything to fear. How do you react to those arguments?
Well, they both have merit. The problem is, though, that, and it is a defensive alliance, but it uses preemptory or forward attacks after the end of the Cold War. So we decided that there was a humanitarian crisis in the Balkans, so we projected force into non-NATO countries like Serbia. Or we went into Afghanistan. That's fine. But it wasn't just that one country was attacked by another one. So we say that Article 5 is only a defensive, but no NATO country that I know of said, I'm being threatened by Milosevic. The argument was, this is a threat to the idea of Europe's humanity, and Afghanistan is a threat to Westernism, which is all, you know, defensible. But it's not, my country is being invaded by a common enemy. Would you please come and help me? So that's the first thing that's a little difficult. The second thing is that we all know Putin is a thug. We know the Chinese leaders are thugs. We know that the Iranian leaders. But this constant demonization of Putin is very bizarre, because the previous administration, I mean, it was Hillary Clinton who pushed the reset button. We heard the hot mic exchange that Obama had with the Russian outgoing president. We know all about the lack of response to Ukraine aggression in Ukraine. We know that the sanctions were not as tough as they are now. We know that Putin liked the idea we cut back on oil production, or at least drilling in some places. So it's very ironic to hear that Trump is under suspicion of not being tough enough on Putin. And the result of that is that he has to prove every day that he's tough. I'm going to have tougher sanctions, and I'm going to have tougher sanctions. And it's hard to know what more we're going to do to the Russians. We've indicted Russians. We've barred Russians from coming. I think the head of their Duma cannot come in the United States. We have the toughest sanctions we've ever had on them. We have indicted individual Russians. And so we're going to beef up NATO's forward deployment, supposedly, to help the Scandinavian countries' worries about Baltic incursions. But in the meantime, I think it's important when people talk about the Crimea, I mean, they have no sense of history. 100,000 Russians died at Sevastopol in the siege of 1942. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And the encirclement at Ukraine outside of Kiev, Baba Yar, we all remember the mini Holocaust of, I think it was 35,000 Jews were just executed by Army Group Center. But the encirclement was the largest encirclement in the history of warfare. 700,000 Russians were killed in eastern Ukraine. So I'm sure we would get very angry if Puerto Rican nationalists invited the Russians into Puerto Rico, and we talk about San Juan Hill and Cuba, and we talk about all these other things in the Caribbean that we've done. And it's sort of the same thing with the Russians. The territory is not quite, I know it's independent and autonomous, but they have historical claims and memories of 27 million people dying in many of these places like Kiev and Sevastopol. And so for us just to say, well, they're independent republics, and they're making deals with NATO, and our Navy can have a base there. It's not realistic, given the Russian psyche.
You mentioned this in passing a moment ago, but I just want to put a finer point on it. How do you react to the fashion in which President Trump has called NATO members out on the fact that their defense spending is not reaching the levels that they had committed to? Because this was a longstanding complaint for conservatives for years. But now, because the president is very direct and sort of pugilistic in his approach, a lot of them sort of blanch at it. Is it fair to say that the president is doing this with too much bluster? Or could one argue that this is actually what it takes, and any more delicate approach would probably lead to a lot of polite acknowledgments of the complaint, but no real action?
Well, you just described the 8-year policy of Obama. Remember, he went over there and called them freeloaders. You guys are freeloaders. You're not paying your fair share. And they kind of said, well, you're a wonderful guy, Barack, but you don't understand our social welfare commitments and obligations. We just can't do it. Sorry. And that was it. And Trump comes along as a businessman and says, no, this is just a joke. I would kind of be reductionist in the sense that Germany is the largest population territory in Europe. And Germany runs a mercantile system. So they run up huge trade deficits with most other European Union countries and with us, $65 billion a year. So if you're Greek or you're Spanish or you're Italian, the German Deutsche Bank says this is how it's going to be. If you're Hungarian, about paying your bills back. If you're Hungarian or Czech or Polish, you said this is how your immigration is going to be. If you're Britain and you want out, this is how Brexit's going to be. And if you're in the United States and you defend Germany, this is how it's going to be. You're going to have a tariff on cars that's, you know, four times lower than our tariff on your cars. That's what we expect, and we're going to run $65 billion. If you object, you're not for free trade. Meanwhile, we're going to warp the whole global financial system and commercial system by running up, as I said, 260 plus billion, more than China. When countries in the EU look at that, the 28 other countries, they said, whatever Germany's going to do, we're going to do. And the same thing holds true of NATO countries. So when Germany says, we're only going to spend 1.3% of our GDP on defense, we have historical qualms, we want to be good NATO, whatever pretense or genuine or inauthentic they put on it, the other countries are going to follow. So Trump looks at Germany and he singles them out and he gets in a big fight with Merkel and he says, you're going to pay. And the Germans are saying, maybe we should become nuclear. There was an article the other day, German scholar. Maybe we should do this. But if Germany pays their 2%, believe me, all of the other NATO countries will. And if Germany doesn't, they won't. Not more than 4 or 5 of them. And so that's what we're really talking about. Will Germany be the transatlantic model and live up to its obligations, or is it its anti-Americanism so much that it's telling the United States we have a right to adjudicate immigration in Europe the way we see fit, we have a right to collect debts the way we see it fit, we have a right to trade with you the way we see fit, we have the right to tell Britain this is how they can get out, and we have a right to arm ourselves as we see fit. And of course, we say, okay, if you want to do that, that's fine, and if you think Russia's the enemy, then, and you want to have a $4 billion gas deal, that's fine, but we're just not going to take this as seriously as we used to. And then we have the elite on both sides that say that this is heresy, blasphemy, but it really isn't. Most people want to see changes, and Trump believes in going to the brink rhetorically and posturing and demonizing and then hoping that he can get a slightly better deal than what was there before. I think he'll probably get a better deal. I don't think he'll get 2% out of Germany, but they'll probably get 1.7 or something, which is a lot better than 1.2 or 3.
So the last question that I'll put to you, Victor, as we close up, what's the bigger threat? A NATO that is too expansive or a NATO that pulls back too much?
Well, those two different questions, you know, pull backs too much in the sense of a smaller membership, or a NATO that's too expansive in terms of a larger membership. Obviously, in a war, the larger the NATO membership is, counterintuitively, the weaker it is, because when you add all of these little countries, you get more and more exposures, more and more chances that something can go wrong on a frontier, and then all of the other countries are responsible because they don't have Bulgaria or Albania or Lithuania, they don't have the assets. But they're close enough to hotspots where they can get you in a war. So in that sense, they don't contribute that much manpower or technology or hardware to the arsenal of NATO, but they do contribute a lot of exposure. So in that sense, I think the smaller and the more cohesive and united the alliance is, the better it would work. So if you're talking about the original idea of the Netherlands and Britain and France, what was East, West Germany and Italy, maybe Greece, then you've got an alliance and an organization that's on the same page. I didn't mention Turkey because it seems to me that Turkey is an outlying country now. We don't know quite where it's going or what it is, but we can't define it, but we know when we see it that it's not quite NATO.
All right. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in. And remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhansen.com. And if you enjoy The Classicists, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hansen, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.